Beside me, Savardin stared vaguely off into the distance. I was forced to put down the money. I had a strong suspicion I would never see it again. Then the proprietor demanded extra because I couldn't display a local pilot certification. Something I knew wasn't required. If it had been, I would have forged one before I came. In the end, though, she gave me the flyer. I checked its engine, which seemed clean and in good repair, and made sure of the fuel. When I was satisfied, I put my pack in, seated Savardin, and then climbed into the pilot's seat. 2 days after the storm, the snow moss was beginning to show again. Sweeps of pale green, with darker threads here and there. After 2 more hours, we flew over a line of hills, and the green darkened dramatically, lined and irregularly veined in a dozen shades, like malachite. In some places, the moss was smeared and trampled by the creatures that grazed on it, herds of long-haired bove making their way southward as spring advanced. And along those paths, on the edges here and there, ice devils lay in carefully tunneled lairs, waiting for a bove to put a foot wrong so they could drag it down. I saw no trace of them, but even the herders who lived their lives following the bove couldn't always tell when one was near. It was easy flying. Savardin sat half lying and quiet beside me. How could she be alive? And how had she ended up here now? It was beyond improbable. But improbable things happened. Nearly 1,000 years before Lieutenant Onn was even born, Savardin had captained a ship of her own, Sword of Nathtas, and had lost it. Most of the human crew, including Savardin, had managed to get to an escape pod. But hers had never been found, that I had heard. Yet here she was. Someone must have found her relatively recently. She was lucky to be alive. I was 4 billion miles away when Savardin lost her ship. I was patrolling a city of glass and polished red stone, silent but for the sound of my own feet, and the conversation of my lieutenants, and, occasionally, me trying my voices against the echoing pentagonal plazas. Falls of flowers, red and yellow and blue, draped the walls surrounding houses with five-sided courtyards. The flowers were wilting. No one dared walk the streets except me and my officers. Everyone knew the likely fate of any person placed under arrest. Instead, they huddled in their houses, waiting for what would come next, wincing or shuddering at the sound of a lieutenant laughing, or my singing. What trouble we'd run into, I and my lieutenants, had been sporadic. The Garcetti had put up only nominal resistance. Troop carriers had emptied. The Swords and Mercies were essentially on guard duty around the system. Representatives from the 5 zones of each of the 5 regions, 25 in all, speaking for the various moons, planets, and stations in the Garcetti system, had surrendered in the name of their constituents and were separately on their way to Sword of Amat to meet Anander Mienai, Lord of the Roch, and beg for the lives of their people. Hence, that frightened, silent city. In a narrow diamond-shaped park, by a black granite monument inscribed with the 5 rite actions, and the name of the Garcetti patron who had wished to impress them on the local residents, one of my lieutenants passed another and complained that this annexation had been disappointingly dull. 3 seconds later, I received a message from Captain Savardin's Sword of Nathtas. The 3 Garcetti electors she was carrying had killed 2 of her lieutenants, and 12 of Sword of Nathtas's ancillary segments. They had damaged the ship, cut conduits, breached the hull. Accompanying the report, a recording from Sword of Nathtas, The gun that an ancillary segment saw irrefutably, but that according to Sword of Nathtas's other sensors, just didn't exist. A Garcetti elector, against all expectations, surrounded by the gleaming silver of Rodchai-style armor that only the ancillary's eyes could see, firing the gun, the bullet piercing the ancillary's armor, killing the segment, and, with its eyes gone, the gun and armor flickering back into non-existence. All the electors had been searched before boarding, and Sword of Nathtas should have been able to detect any weapon or shield-generating device or implant. And while Rodchai-style armor had once been in common use in the regions surrounding the Rach itself, those regions had been absorbed 1,000 years before. The Garcetti didn't use it, didn't know how to make it, let alone how to use it. And even if they had, that gun and its bullet were flatly impossible. 3 people armed with such a gun and armored could do a great deal of damage on a ship like Sword of Nathtas, especially if even 1 Garcetti could reach the engine, and if such a gun could pierce the engine's heat shield. Rodchai warship engines burned star hot, and a failed heat shield meant instant vaporization, an entire ship dissolved in a brief bright flash. But there was nothing I could do. Nothing anyone could do. The message was nearly 4 hours old. A signal from the past. A ghost. The issue had been decided even before it had reached me. A harsh tone sounded, and a blue light blinked on the panel in front of me, beside the fuel indicator. An instant before, the indicator had read nearly full. Now it read empty. The engine would shut down in a matter of minutes. Beside me, Savard sprawled, relaxed and quiet. I landed. The fuel tank had been rigged in a way I hadn't detected. It seemed 3/4 full, but it wasn't, and the alarm that ought to have sounded when I'd used half of what I'd started with had been disconnected. I thought of the double deposit I certainly wouldn't see again, of the proprietor, so concerned that she might lose her valuable flyer. Of course there would be a transmitter, whether or not I triggered the emergency call. The proprietor wouldn't want to lose the flyer, just strand me alone in the middle of this plain of moss-streaked snow. I could call for help. I had disabled my communication implants, but I did have a handheld I could use. But we were very, very far from anyone who might be moved to send assistance. And even if help came, and came before the proprietor, who clearly meant me no good, I wouldn't get where I was going. A matter of great importance to me. The air was minus 18 degrees. The breeze from the south, at approximately 8 kph, implied snow sometime in the near future. Nothing serious, if the morning's weather report could be trusted. My landing had left a green-edged smear of white in the snow moss, easily visible from the air. The terrain seemed gently hilly, though hills we'd flown over were no longer visible. Had this been an ordinary emergency, the best course would have been to stay inside the flyer until help came. But this wasn't an ordinary emergency, and I didn't expect rescue. Either they would come as soon as their transmitter told them we were grounded, prepared to murder, or they would wait. The rental had several other vehicles. The proprietor would likely not be inconvenienced if she waited even several weeks to retrieve her flyer. As she herself had said, no one would be surprised if a foreigner lost herself in the snow. I had 2 choices. I could wait here and hope to ambush anyone who came to murder and rob me, and take their transport. This would, of course, be futile in the event that they decided to wait for cold and hunger to do their job for them. Or I could pull Savard in out of the flyer, shoulder my pack, and walk. My intended destination was some 60 kilometers to the southeast. I could walk that in a day if I had to, ground and weather, and ice devils permitting. But I would be lucky if Savardin could do it in twice that time. And that course would be futile if the proprietor decided not to wait, but to retrieve her flyer more or less immediately. Our trail through the moss-striated snow would be clear. They would need only to follow us and dispose of us. I would have lost any advantage of surprise I might have gained by hiding near the downed flyer. And I would be lucky if I found anything once I reached my destination. I had spent the past 19 years following the most tenuous of threads, weeks and months of searching or waiting, punctuated by moments like this, when success, or even life, hung on the toss of a coin. I had been lucky to come this far. I couldn't reasonably expect to go farther. A Rodchai would have tossed that coin, or more accurately, a handful of them. A dozen discs, each with its meaning and import, the pattern of their fall, a map of the universe as Amat willed it to be. Things happen the way they happen because the world is the way it is. Or, as a Rodchai would say, the universe is the shape of the gods. Amat conceived of light, and conceiving of light also necessarily conceived of not light, and light and darkness sprang forth. This was the first emanation, a trepabo, light, darkness. The other three implied and necessitated by the first are Eskvar, beginning, ending, Issa Inu, movement, stillness, and Van Eter, existence, non-existence. These four emanations variously split and recombined to create the universe. Everything that is emanates from Amat. The smallest, most seemingly insignificant event is part of an intricate whole. And to understand why one particular mote of dust falls in one particular path and lands in one particular location is to understand the will of Amat. There is no such thing as just a coincidence. Nothing happens by chance, but only according to the mind of God. Or so official Rodchai orthodoxy teaches. I myself have never understood religion very well. It was never required that I should. And though the Rodchai had made me, I wasn't Rodchai. I knew and cared nothing about the will of the gods. I only knew that I would land where I myself had been cast, wherever that would be. I took my pack from the flyer, opened it, and removed an extra magazine, which I stowed inside my coat near my gun. I shouldered the pack, went around to the other side of the flyer, and opened the hatch there. "Savardin," I said. She didn't move, only breathed a quiet, "Hmm." I took her arm and pulled, and she half-slid, half-stepped, out into the snow. I had gotten this far by taking one step and then another. I turned northeast, pulling Savardin along, and walked. Dr. Aerolesperus Stregan, whose home I very much hoped I was walking toward, had been, at one time, a medic in private practice on Dras Ania Station. An aggregation of at least 5 different stations, one built onto another, at the intersection of 2 dozen different routes, well outside Roch territory. Nearly anything could end up there, given enough time, and in the course of her work, she had met a wide variety of people with a wide variety of antecedents. She had been paid in currency, in favors, in antiques, in nearly anything that might imaginably be said to have value. I'd been there, seen the station and its convoluted, interpenetrating layers, seen where Stregan had worked and lived. seen the things she'd left behind when one day, for no reason anyone seemed to know, she'd bought passage on 5 different ships and then disappeared. A case full of stringed instruments, only 3 of which I could name. 5 shelves of icons, a dizzying array of gods and saints worked in wood, in shell, in gold. 12 guns, each one carefully labeled with its station permit number. These were collections that had begun as single items, received in payment, sparking her curiosity. Striegen's lease had been paid in full for 150 years, and as a result, station authorities had left her apartment untouched. A bribe had gotten me in to see the collection I had come for. A few 5-sided tiles in colors still flower bright after 1,000 years. A shallow bowl inscribed around its gilt edge in a language Striegen couldn't possibly have read. A flat plastic rectangle I knew was a voice recorder. At a touch, it produced laughter, voices speaking that same dead language. Small as it was, this hadn't been an easy collection to assemble. Garcetti artifacts were scarce, because once Anander Mianai had realized the Garcetti possessed the means to destroy Radchai ships and penetrate Radchai armor, she had ordered the utter destruction of Garced and its people. Those pentagonal plazas, the flowers, every living thing on every planet, moon, and station in the system, all gone. No one would ever live there again. No one would ever be permitted to forget what it meant to defy the Rotch. Had a patient given her, say, the bowl, and had that sent her looking for more information? And if one Garcetti object had fetched up there, what else might have? Something a patient might have given her as payment, maybe not knowing what it was, or knowing and wanting desperately to be rid of it. Something that had led Striegen to flee, to disappear, leaving nearly everything she owned behind, perhaps. Something dangerous. Something she couldn't bring herself to destroy, to be rid of in the most efficient way possible. Something I wanted very badly. I wanted to get as far as we possibly could, as quickly as we possibly could, and so we walked for hours, with only the briefest of stops when absolutely necessary. Though the day was clear, and bright as it ever gets on Nilt, I felt blind in a way that I had thought I had learned to ignore by now. I had once had 20 bodies, 20 pairs of eyes, and hundreds of others that I could access if I needed or desired it. Now I could only see in one direction, could only see the vast expanse behind me, if I turned my head and blinded myself to what was in front of me. Usually I dealt with this by avoiding 2 open spaces, by making sure of just what was at my back, but here that was impossible. My face burned, despite the very gentle breeze, then numbed. My hands and feet ached at first. I hadn't bought my gloves or boots with the intention of walking 60 kilometers in the cold. And then grew heavy and numb. I was fortunate I hadn't come in winter, when temperatures could be a great deal lower. Savarden must have been just as cold, but she walked steadily as I pulled her along, step after apathetic step. Feet dragging through the mossy snow, staring down, not complaining or even speaking at all. When the sun was nearly on the horizon, she shifted her shoulders just slightly and raised her head. "I know that song," she said. "What?" "That song you're humming." Lazily she turned her head toward me, her face showing no anxiety or perplexity at all. I wondered if she had made any effort to conceal her accent. Likely not. On Kef as she was, she wouldn't care. Inside Roch territories, that accent declared her a member of a wealthy and influential house, someone who, after taking the aptitudes at 15, would have ended up with a prestigious assignment. Outside those territories, it was an easy shorthand for a villain. Rich, corrupt, and callous, in a thousand entertainments. The faint sound of a flyer reached us. I turned without stopping, searched the horizon, and saw it, small and distant. Flying low and slowly, following our trail, it seemed. It wasn't a rescue, I was sure. My toss had landed wrong, and now we were exposed and defenseless. We kept walking as the sound of the flyer grew nearer. We couldn't have outraced it even if Savardin hadn't begun to half-stumble, catching herself, but clearly at the end of her endurance. If she was speaking unprompted, noticing anything around her, she was likely beginning to come down. I stopped, dropped her arm, and she came to a halt beside me. The flyer sailed over us, banked, and landed in our path, approximately 30 meters in front of us. Either they didn't have the means to shoot us from the air, or they didn't wish to. I shrugged off my pack and loosened the fastenings of my outer coat, the better to reach my gun. 4 people got out of the flyer. The owner I had rented from, 2 people I didn't recognize, and the person from the bar who had called me a tough little girl and whom I had wanted to kill but had refrained from killing. I slid my hand into my coat and grasped the gun. My options were limited.
"Don't you have any common sense?" called the proprietor when they were 15 meters away. All 4 stopped. "You stay with a flyer when it goes down so we can find you."
I looked at the person from the bar, saw her recognize me, and see that I recognized her. In the bar, I said that anyone who tried to rob me would die, I reminded her. She smirked. One of the people I didn't recognize produced a gun from somewhere on her person.
"We aren't gonna just try," she said.
I drew my gun and fired, hitting her in the face. She crumpled to the snow. Before the others could react, I shot the person from the bar, who likewise fell, and then the person beside her, all 3 in quick succession, taking less than 1 second. The proprietor swore and turned to flee. I shot her in the back, and she took 3 steps and then fell. "I'm cold," said Savardin beside me, placid and heedless. They had left the flyer unguarded, all 4 approaching me. Foolish. The whole venture had been foolish. Undertaken without any sort of serious planning, it seemed. I had only to load Savardin and my pack into the flyer and be off. The residence of Aralesperus Stregan was barely visible from the air. Only a circle slightly more than 35 meters in diameter, within which the snow moss was perceptibly lighter and thinner. I brought the flyer down outside the circle and waited a moment to assess the situation. From this angle, it was obvious there were buildings, 2 of them, snow-covered mounds. It might have been an unoccupied herding camp, but if I could trust my information, it wasn't. There was no sign of a wall or fence, but I would make no assumptions about her security. After consideration, I opened the hatch on the flyer and got out, pulling Savardin out behind me. We walked slowly to the line where the snow changed, Savardin stopping when I stopped. She stood incuriously staring straight ahead. Beyond this, I hadn't been able to plan. "Stregan!" I called and waited. But no answer came. I left Savardin standing where she was and walked the circumference of the circle. The entrances of the 2 snow-mounded buildings seemed oddly shadowed, and I stopped and looked again. Both hung open, dark beyond. Buildings like these would probably have double-doored entrances, like an airlock, to keep warm air inside. But I didn't think anyone would leave either door hanging ajar. Either Striegen had security in place or she didn't. I stepped over the line into the circle. Nothing happened. The doors were open, both inner and outer, and there were no lights. One of the buildings was just as cold inside as out. I presumed that when I found a light, I would discover it was used for storage, filled with tools and sealed packages of food and fuel. The other was 2 degrees Celsius inside. I guessed that it had been heated until relatively recently. Living quarters, evidently. Striegen! I called into the darkness, but the way my voice echoed back told me the building was likely unoccupied. Outside again, I found the marks where her flyer had sat. She was gone then, and the open doors and the darkness were a message for whoever would come. For me. I had no means to discover where she'd gone. I looked up at the empty sky, and down again at the imprint of the flyer. I stood there a while, looking at that empty space. When I returned to Savarden, I found she'd lain down in the green-stained snow and gone to sleep. In the back of the flyer, I found a lantern, a stove, a tent, and some bedding. I took the lantern into the building I presumed was living quarters and switched it on. Wide, light-colored rugs covered the floor, and woven hangings the walls. These were blue and orange, and an eye-hurting green. Low benches, backless with cushions, lined the room. Beyond benches and the bright hangings, there was little else. A game board with counters, but the board had a pattern of holes I didn't recognize, and I didn't understand the distribution of the counters among the holes. I wondered whom Striegen played with. Perhaps the board was only decorative. It was finely carved, and the pieces brightly colored. A wooden box sat on a table in a corner, a long oval with a carved, pierced lid and 3 strings stretched tight across. The wood was pale gold, with a waving, curling grain. The holes cut in the flat top were as uneven and intricate as the grain of the wood. It was a beautiful thing. I plucked a string and it rang softly. Doors led to the kitchen, bath, sleeping quarters, and what was obviously a small infirmary. I opened a cabinet door and found a neat stack of correctives. Each drawer I pulled out revealed instruments and medicines. She might have gone to a herding camp to tend to some emergency, but the lights and the heat being off, and those doors left open, argued otherwise. Barring a miracle, it was the end of 19 years of planning and effort. The house controls were behind a panel in the kitchen. I found the power supply in place, hooked it back in, and switched on the heat and the lights. Then I went out and got Savarden and dragged her into the house. I made a pallet of blankets I found in Striegen's bedroom, then stripped Savarden and laid her on it, and covered her with more blankets. She didn't wake, and I used the time to search the house more thoroughly. The cabinets held plenty of food. A cup sat on the counter, a thin layer of greenish liquid glazing the bottom. Next to it sat a plain white bowl holding the last bits of a hunk of hard bread disintegrating into ice-rimmed water. It looked as though Striegen had left without cleaning up after a meal, leaving nearly everything behind. Food, medical supplies. I checked the bedroom, found warm clothes in good repair. She had left on short notice, not taking much. She knew what she had. Of course she did. That was why she'd fled to begin with. If she wasn't stupid, and I was quite certain she wasn't, she had gone the moment she realized what I was, and would keep going until she was as far from me as she could get. But where would that be?
If I represented the power of the Rotch, and had found her even here, so distant from both Rotch space and her own home, where could she go that they wouldn't ultimately find her? Surely she would realize that. But what other course would be open to her? Surely she wouldn't be foolish enough to return. In the meantime, Saevardin would be sick soon unless I found Kef for her. I had no intention of doing that, and there was food here, and heat, and perhaps I could find something, some hint, some clue to what Striegen had been thinking in the moment she had thought the Rotch were coming for her, and fled. Something that would tell me where she'd gone. Chapter 4. At night in Orz, I walked the streets and looked out over the still stinking water, dark beyond the few lights of Orz itself, and the blinking of the buoys surrounding the prohibited zones. I slept also, and sat watch in the lower level of the house, in case anyone should need me, though that was rare in those days. I finished any of the day's work still uncompleted, and watched over Lieutenant On, who lay sleeping. Mornings, I brought water for Lieutenant On to bathe in, and dressed her, though the local costume was a good deal less effort than her uniform, and she had stopped wearing any sort of cosmetics 2 years before, as they were difficult to maintain in the heat. Then Lieutenant On would turn to her icons. Four-armed Amat, an emanation in each hand, sat on a box downstairs. But the others, Torin, who received devotions from every officer on Justice of Torin, and a few gods particular to Lieutenant On's family, sat near where Lieutenant On slept, in the upper part of the house, and it was to them that she made her morning devotions. "The flower of justice is peace," the daily prayer began, that every Rodchai soldier said on waking every day of her life in the military. "The flower of propriety is beauty in thought and action." The rest of my officers, still on Justice of Torin, were on a different schedule. Their mornings rarely coincided with Lieutenant On's, so it was almost always Lieutenant On's voice alone in prayer, and the others, when they spoke so far away, in chorus without her. "The flower of benefit is Amat, whole and entire. I am the sword of justice." The prayer is antiphonal, but only 4 verses long. I can sometimes hear it still when I wake, like a distant voice somewhere behind me. Every morning in every official temple throughout Rodchai space, a priest, who doubles as a registrar of births and deaths and contracts of all kinds, casts the day's omens. Households and individuals sometimes cast their own as well, and there's no obligation to attend the official casting. But it's as good an excuse as any to be seen and speak to friends and neighbors and hear gossip. There was, as yet, no official temple in Orz. These are all primarily dedicated to Amat. Any other gods on the premises take lesser places, and the head priest of Ikt hadn't seen her way clear to demoting her god in its own temple, or identifying Ikt with Amat closely enough to add Rodchai rites to her own. So for the moment, Lieutenant On's house served. Each morning the makeshift temple's flower-bearers removed dead flowers from around the icon of Amat, and replace them with fresh ones. Usually a local species with small, bright pink, triple-lobed petals that grew in the dirt that collected on the outside corners of buildings or cracks in slabs, and was the nearest thing to a weed, but greatly admired by the children. And lately, small cupped blue and white lilies had been blooming in the lake, especially near the buoy-barricaded prohibited areas. Then Lieutenant On would lay out the cloth for the omen casting, and the omens themselves, a handful of weighty metal discs. These and the icons were Lieutenant Awn's personal possessions, gifts from her parents when she had taken the aptitudes and received her assignment. Occasionally, only Lieutenant Awn and the day's attendants came to the morning ritual, but usually others were present. The town's medic, a few of the Rod-Chai who had been granted property here, other Orzean children who couldn't be persuaded to go to school, or care about being on time for it, and liked the glitter and ring of the discs as they fell. Sometimes even the head priest of Ikt would come. That god, like Amat, not demanding that its followers refuse to acknowledge other gods. Once the omens fell and came to rest on the cloth, or, to any spectator's dread, rolled off the cloth and away somewhere harder to interpret, the priest officiating was supposed to identify the pattern, match it with its associated passage of scripture, and recite that for those present. It wasn't something Lieutenant Awn was always able to do, so instead she tossed the omens, I observed their fall, and then I transmitted the appropriate words to her. Justice of Torin was, after all, nearly 2,000 years old and had seen nearly every possible configuration. The ritual done, she would have breakfast, usually a round of bread from whatever local grain was available and real tea, and then take her place on the mat and platform and wait for the day's requests and complaints. "Jen Shinnan invites you to supper this evening," I told her that next morning. I also ate breakfast, cleaned weapons, walked the streets, and greeted those who spoke to me. Jen Shinnan lived in the Upper City, and before the annexation she had been the wealthiest person in Orz, in influence second only to the head priest of Ikt. Lieutenant Awn disliked her. "I suppose I don't have a good excuse to refuse." "Not that I can see," I said. I also stood at the perimeter of the house, nearly on the street, and watched. An Orzean approached, saw me, slowed, stopped about 8 meters away, pretending to look above me at something else. "Anything else?" asked Lieutenant Awn. "The district magistrate reiterates the official policy regarding fishing reserves in the Orz marshes." Lieutenant Awn sighed. "Yes, of course she does." "Can I help you, citizen?" I asked the person still hesitating in the street. The impending arrival of her first grandchild hadn't yet been announced to the neighbors, so I pretended I didn't know either and used only the simple, respectful address toward a male person. "I wish," Lieutenant Awn continued, "the magistrate would come here herself and try living on stale bread and those disgusting pickled vegetables they send, and see how she likes being forbidden to fish where all the fish actually are." The Orzean in the street started, looked for a moment as if she were going to turn around and walk away, and changed her mind. "Good morning, Rod-Chai," she said, quietly coming closer. "And to the lieutenant as well." Orzeans were blunt when it suited them, and at other times, oddly, frustratingly reticent. "I know there's a reason for it," said Lieutenant Awn to me, "and she's right, but still..." She sighed again. "Anything else?" "Den's eye is outside and wishes to speak to you." As I spoke, I invited Den's eye to step within the house.
"What about?"
"Something she seems unwilling to mention." Lieutenant Awn gestured acknowledgement, and I brought Den's eye around the screens. She bowed and sat on the mat in front of Lieutenant Awn.
"Good morning, citizen," said Lieutenant Awn. I translated.
"Good morning, Lieutenant."
And by slow, careful degrees, beginning with an observation on the heat and the cloudless sky, progressing through inquiries about Lieutenant Awn's health, to mild local gossip, she finally came around to hinting at her reason for coming.
I...
I have a friend, Lieutenant.
She stopped.
Yes?
Yesterday evening, my friend was fishing.
Den's eye stopped again. Lieutenant On waited 3 seconds, and when nothing further seemed forthcoming, she asked, Did your friend catch much?
When the mood was on them, no amount of direct questioning or begging an Orzean to come to the point would avail.
Not much, said Den's eye.
And then, irritation flashing across her face just for an instant.
The best fishing, you know, is near the breeding areas, and those are all prohibited.
Yes, said Lieutenant On.
I'm sure your friend would never fish illegally.
No, of course not,
Den's eye protested.
But I don't want to get her in trouble. But maybe sometimes she digs tubers near the prohibited zones.
There weren't really any plants that produced edible tubers near the prohibited zones. They'd all been dug up months ago, if not longer. Poachers were more careful about the ones inside. If the plants decreased too noticeably or disappeared entirely, we'd be forced to find out who was taking them and guard them much more closely. Lieutenant On knew this. Everyone in the lower city knew it. Lieutenant On waited for the rest of the story, not for the first time annoyed at the Orzean tendency to approach topics by stealth, but managing mostly not to show it.
I've heard they're very good, she ventured.
Oh, yes, agreed Den's eye. They're best right out of the mud.
Lieutenant On suppressed a grimace.
But you can slice them and grill them, too.
Den's eye stopped with a shrewd look.
Perhaps my friend can get some for you.
I saw Lieutenant On's dissatisfaction with her rations, the momentary desire to say, yes, please, but instead she said,
Thank you, there's no need. You were saying?
Saying?
Your friend?
As she spoke, Lieutenant On was asking me questions with minute twitches of her fingers.
Was digging tubers near a prohibited zone?
And?
I showed Lieutenant On the spot this person was most likely to have been digging in. I patrolled all of Orz, saw the boats go in and out, saw where they were at night when they doused lights, and maybe even thought they were running invisible to me.
And, said Den's eye, they found something.
Anyone missing? Lieutenant On asked me, silently alarmed. I replied in the negative.
What did they find? Lieutenant On asked Den's eye aloud.
Guns, said Den's eye.
So quietly, Lieutenant On almost didn't hear.
A dozen. From before.
From before the annexation, she meant. All the Shasernan militaries had been relieved of their weapons. No one on the planet should have had any guns we didn't already know about. The answer was so surprising that for a blinking 2 seconds, Lieutenant On didn't react at all. Then came puzzlement, alarm, and confusion.
Why is she telling me this? Lieutenant On asked me silently.
There's been some talk, Lieutenant, said Den's eye. Perhaps you've heard it.
There's always talk, acknowledged Lieutenant On. The answer so formulaic, I didn't need to translate it for her. She could say it in the local dialect. How else are people to pass the time? Den's eye conceded this conventional point with a gesture. Lieutenant On's patience frayed, and she attacked directly. They might have been put there before the annexation. Den's eye made a negative motion with her left hand.
They weren't there a month ago.
Did someone find a pre-annexation cache and hide them there?
Lieutenant On asked me silently.
Aloud, she asked, "When people talk, do they say things that might account for the appearance of a dozen guns underwater in a prohibited zone?"
"Such guns are no good against you."
"Because of our armor," Denzai meant. "Rodchai armor is an essentially impenetrable force shield. I could extend mine at a thought, the moment I desired to do so. The mechanism that generated it was implanted in each of my segments. And Lieutenant On had it as well, though hers was an externally worn unit. It didn't make us completely invulnerable, and in combat, we sometimes wore actual pieces of armor under it, lightweight and articulated, covering head and limbs and torso. But even without that, a handful of guns wouldn't do much damage to either of us."
"So who would those guns be meant for?" asked Lieutenant On.
Denzai considered, frowning, biting her lip, and then said,
"The Tanmind are more like the Rodchai than we are."
"Citizen," said Lieutenant On, laying noticeable deliberate stress on that word, which was only what Rodchai meant in the first place. "If we were going to shoot anyone here, we'd already have done it."
"Had already done it, in fact.
We wouldn't need secret stashes of weapons."
"This is why I came to you," said Denzai, emphatic, as though explaining something in very simple terms for a child. "When you shoot a person, you say why and do it without excuse. This is how the Rodchai are. But in the upper city, before you came, when they would shoot Orzeans, they would always be careful to have an excuse. They wanted someone dead," she explained to Lieutenant On's uncomprehending, appalled expression. "They didn't say, 'You are trouble, we want you gone,' and then shoot. They said, 'We are only defending ourselves,' and when the person was dead, they would search the body or a house and discover weapons or incriminating messages."
Not, the implication was clear, genuine ones.
"Then how are we alike?"
"Your gods are the same."
They weren't, not explicitly so, but the fiction was encouraged in the upper city and elsewhere.
"You live in space. You go all wrapped up in clothes. You are rich. The Tanmind are rich. If someone in the upper city,"
and by this I suspected she meant a specific someone,
"cries out that some Orzean threatens them, most Rodchai will believe her, and not some Orzean who is surely lying to protect her own."
And that was why she had come to Lieutenant On, so that, whatever happened, it would be plain and clear to Rodchai authorities that she, and by extension anyone else in the lower city, had in fact had nothing to do with that cache of weapons, if the accusation should materialize.
"These things," said Lieutenant On, "Orzean, Tanmind, Moha, they mean nothing now. That's done. Everyone here is Rodchai."
"As you say, Lieutenant," answered Denzai,
voice quiet and nearly expressionless. Lieutenant On had been in Orz long enough to recognize the unstated refusal to agree. She tried another angle. "No one is going to shoot anybody."
"Of course not, Lieutenant," said Denzai,
but in that same quiet voice. She was old enough to know firsthand that we had, indeed, shot people in the past. She could hardly be blamed for fearing we might do so in the future. After Denzai left, Lieutenant On sat thinking. No one interrupted. The day was quiet.
In the green-lit temple interior, the head priest turned to me and said,
"Once there would have been 2 choirs, 100 voices each. You would have liked it."
I had seen recordings. Sometimes the children would bring me songs that were distant echoes of that music, 500 years gone and more.
"We're not what we used to be," said the head priest. "Everything passes eventually."
I agreed that it was so. "Take a boat tonight," said Lieutenant On, stirring at last. "See if there's anything to indicate where the weapons came from. I'll decide what to do once I have a better idea of what's going on."
"Yes, Lieutenant," I said.
Jen Shinnan lived in the upper city, across the Four Temple Lake. Few Orzeans lived there who weren't servants. The houses there were built to a slightly different plan from those in the lower. Hip-roofed, the central part of each floor walled in, though windows and doors were left open on mild nights. All of the upper city had been built over older ruins, and thus, much more recently than the lower, within the last 50 or so years, and made much larger use of climate control. Many residents wore trousers and shirts and even jackets. Rodchai immigrants who lived there tended to wear much more conventional clothes, and Lieutenant On, when she visited, wore her uniform without too much discomfort. But Lieutenant On was never comfortable visiting Jen Shinnan. She didn't like Jen Shinnan. And though, of course, it was never even hinted at, very likely Jen Shinnan didn't like Lieutenant On much either. This sort of invitation was only extended out of social necessity, Lieutenant On being a local representative of Rodchai authority. The table this evening was unusually small, just Jen Shinnan, a cousin of hers, and Lieutenant On and Lieutenant Skyot. Lieutenant Skyot commanded Justice of Entei 7 Issa and administered the territory between Ors and Kuld Ves, farmland mostly, where Jen Shinnan and her cousin had their holdings. Lieutenant Skyot and her troops assisted us during pilgrimage season, so she was nearly as well known in Ors as Lieutenant On was.
"They confiscated my entire harvest!"
This was the cousin of Jen Shinnan's, the owner of several tamarind orchards not far from the upper city. She tapped her plate emphatically with her utensil.
"The entire harvest!"
The center of the table was laden with trays and bowls, filled with eggs, fish, not from the marshy lake but from the sea beyond, spiced chicken, bread, braised vegetables, and 6 relishes of various types. "Didn't they pay you, citizen?" asked Lieutenant On, speaking slowly and carefully, as she always did when she was anxious her accent might slip. Jen Shinnan and her cousin both spoke Rodchai, so there was no need to translate, nor any anxiety over gender or status or anything else that would have been essential in Tanmind or Orzean.
"Well, but I would certainly have gotten more if I could have taken it to Kuld Ves and sold it myself."
There had been a time when a property owner like her would have been shot early on, so someone's client could take over her plantation. Indeed, not a few Shisernans had died in the initial stages of the annexation simply because they were in the way. And in the way could mean any number of things. "As I'm sure you understand, citizen," said Lieutenant On, "food distribution is a problem we're still solving, and we all need to endure some hardship while that's accomplished." Her sentences, when she was uncomfortable, became uncharacteristically formal and sometimes dangerously convoluted. Jen Shinnan gestured to a laden plate of fragile, pale pink glass.
"Another stuffed egg, Lieutenant On."
Lieutenant On held up one gloved hand. "They're delicious, but no, thank you, citizen."
but the cousin had landed in a track she found it hard to deviate from, despite Jen Shinnin's diplomatic attempt to derail her.
"It's not like fruit is a necessity. Tamarind, of all things. And it's not like anyone is starving."
"Indeed it isn't," agreed Lieutenant Skyot heartily.
She smiled brightly at Lieutenant On. Lieutenant Skyot, dark-skinned, amber-eyed, aristocratic as Lieutenant On was not. One of her seven Issas stood near me, by the door of the dining room, as straight and still as I was. Though Lieutenant On liked Lieutenant Skyot a good deal and appreciated her sarcasm, on this occasion she couldn't bring herself to smile in response. "Not this year."
"Your business is doing better than mine, cousin," said Jen Shinnin, voice placating.
She, too, owned farmland not far from the upper city, but she had also owned those dredgers that sat silent and still in the marsh water.
"Though I suppose I can't be too regretful. It was a great deal of trouble for very little return."
Lieutenant On opened her mouth to speak and then closed it again. Lieutenant Skyot saw it and said, vowels effortlessly broad and refined,
"What is it, another 3 years for the fishing prohibitions, Lieutenant?"
"Yes," said Lieutenant On.
"Foolishness," said Jen Shinnin. "Well-intentioned, but foolish. You saw what it was like when you arrived. As soon as you open them, they'll be fished out again. The Orzeans may have been a great people once, but they're no longer what their ancestors were. They have no ambition, no sense of anything beyond their short-term advantage. If you show them who's boss, then they can be quite obedient, as I'm sure you've discovered, Lieutenant On. But in their natural state, they are, with few exceptions, shiftless and superstitious. Though I suppose that's what comes of living in the underworld."
She smiled at her own joke. Her cousin laughed outright. The space-dwelling nations of Shiserna divided the universe into three parts. In the middle lay the natural environment of humans, space stations, ships, constructed habitats. Outside those was the black, heaven, the home of God, and everything holy. And within the gravity well of the planet Shiserna itself, or for that matter any planet, lay the underworld, the land of the dead from which humanity had had to escape in order to become fully free of its demonic influence. You can see, perhaps, how the Rodchai conception of the universe as being God itself might seem the same as the Tanmind idea of the black. You might also see why it seemed a bit odd, to Rodchai ears, to hear someone who believed gravity wells were the land of the dead call people superstitious for worshipping a lizard. Lieutenant On managed a polite smile, and Lieutenant Skyot said,
"And yet you live here too." "I don't confuse abstract philosophical concepts with reality," said Jen Shinnin.
Though that too sounded odd to a Rodchai who knew what it meant for a Tanmind stationer to descend to the underworld and return.
"Seriously, I have a theory."
Lieutenant On, who had been exposed to several Tanmind theories about the Orzeans, managed a neutral, even almost curious expression and said blandly,
"Oh?"
"Do share," encouraged Lieutenant Skyot.
The cousin, having scooped a quantity of spiced chicken into her mouth moments before, made a gesture of support with her utensil.
"It's the way they live, all out in the open like that, with nothing but a roof," Jen Shinnin said. "They can't have any privacy, no sense of themselves as real individuals, you understand. No sense of any sort of separate identity."
"Let alone private property," said Jen Ta,
having swallowed her chicken.
They think they can just walk in and take whatever they want.
Actually, there were rules, if unstated ones, about entering a house uninvited. And theft was rarely a problem in the lower city. Occasionally during pilgrimage season, almost never otherwise.